On this week's 51%, members of a surf punk band say a nonprofit has given them the confidence to really rock out.
So we try not to compliment each other on just, you know, superficial things like, oh, I love your new haircut or stuff. We try to be more like, oh, I love that riff you played in class.
And we hear from a woman who decides her double life must come to an end. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Import, a Minneapolis surf punk trio, did not meet at a bar or a college. They met at a nonprofit called She Rock, She Rock, and there's a summer camp component called Girls Rock and Roll Retreat, or GRR. KFAI's Ryan Dawes reports that the organization helped instill Last Import members with a loud punk confidence.
In Plymouth, Minnesota, I'm Ryan Dawes. I'm in a basement with a surf punk trio.
Or a leaf blower.
The drummer's dad is just doing a little yard work outside.
We're having an interview! What?
We're interviewing right now, and you're ruining it.
Thank you.
Yeah!
It's already ruined.
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Grace.
And I'm Jane.
And we're Last Import!
Emily sings and plays guitar, Grace plays bass, and Jane is the drummer.
Pretty much everything that we've ever listened to, which can range from Insane Clown Posse to Brian Wilson.
Like, we want to bring a fun dance party, but also kind of like, you know, people wearing some combat boots, like you might get a kick in the teeth, but it'll still be a fun surfy beach party, you know?
All three are just 20 years old, but they've been playing together since they were kids. They met through an organization called She Rock, She Rock.
She Rock, She Rock is a nonprofit organization that empowers women through music.
What they do is provide musical training and classes to young people, girls, gender nonconforming, transgender, just to kind of build confidence in music. They teach instruments there, but they also teach like self-defense and marketing and kind of stuff to be aware of in the media and the portrayal of women in media.
Jane and Grace now teach their respective instruments for the nonprofit. She Rock training and classes are offered throughout the year and at a roving summer camp called GRR.
GRR is Girls Rock and Roll Retreat, so it happens every summer with She Rock. And basically it's where a group of young girls, young women come together and they're placed in different bands and they get to do different workshops. And at the very end, there's a showcase.
GRR has a distinct culture designed to instill confidence and community among the young women. For example, girls there are discouraged from saying, I'm sorry.
If you play a note wrong or something, you say, I rock, and everyone's like, you rock. And then you just yell it. But yeah, it's just super fun. We like cover all the mirrors and write nice things about inner qualities on them. And
so we try not to compliment each other on just, you know, superficial things like, oh, I love your new haircut or stuff. We try to be more like, oh, I love that riff you played in class. I love this and that. So taping up the mirrors just kind of adds to that, focusing on more like your talents and your skills.
These skills honed through She Rock have helped them work their way up from the coffee shops and house parties they played as teenagers to headlining at premier venues throughout the Twin Cities, and even opening at the famed First Avenue. But the ladies of Last Import still meet some skeptics.
Yeah, there was one time we played at a brewery and a guy came up to us afterwards and was like, wow, I really thought you guys were gonna suck, but you did good. And that's what he said to us, and we're like, thanks,
I guess. That's a compliment.
Yeah, I really enjoy proving people wrong. Sometimes, like, you know, people do have these expectations. Three young girls, like, oh, they're cute, their set will be cute, like, it'll be fun, but they don't expect us to rock that hard, and then to kind of, like, change people's minds like that is really eye-opening, and kind of feels like you're conquering something. I had no prior guitar training, but I taught myself guitar. I felt like I was good, but I was afraid I wasn't good enough for other people.
So as a young girl, I was incredibly insecure, and to have words of encouragement like "you rock," that's made such a difference. Because it's so easy, and I know I was like this, for young girls to feel like they're just not good enough. But to realize that you're an individual and you can craft something unique, and altogether you can create something that can really move people and make them dance and make them happy. That's the difference that She Rock made for me.
You'll be my brother, not by blood sugar, but by...
For KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes in Plymouth, Minnesota.
Choices, they tell me why.
For all the support there is for so many different women and girls in a variety of realms, there are women fighting inner battles without inclusive spaces, working to be their true selves. In this vein, an Orthodox Jewish mother has been leading a double life. For years, she kept up the charade until she couldn't. Producer Mishy Harman of Israel's Story met up with her at a particularly vulnerable point along the way.
Setting up an interview with Dvora Sasson, that's not actually her real name, reminded me of planning a covert military operation. There was a very specific window of opportunity. There were places we had to cautiously avoid, and there was, of course, a plausible cover story. We're not using your name here, and we're avoiding all kinds of identifying details and even changing your voice. Why are we doing all of this?
I need to protect myself and my family. I feel uncomfortable if people would know the truth, if people would know who I am.
I asked her what would be so terrible about that.
People might look at me differently, perhaps be disappointed, feel the need to maybe try to change or fix me.
Very few people know Dvora's secret, the one she's so afraid to tell.
Some of the members of my family know, more don't.
And even that's a new development. Dvora has a large family, many kids, a bunch of grandkids. Until very recently, none of them knew a thing.
It's difficult. I wish it wasn't so difficult, but it really is.
Now, I'm not sure what you're imagining right now, but if I had to guess, I'd say you're probably not even close. You see, Dvora's dark secret?
So basically that I...
Brace yourself.
I no longer observe.
That's right. Dvora is no longer religious.
It's not that I've, like, given up on Judaism. I haven't. I just don't want to keep the rules. And I don't.
So this might not seem all that dramatic to you. It didn't to me either at first. But I don't want to trivialize it. Because, well, for Dvora, it's the central theme of her life. And putting myself in her shoes, I can totally understand why.
It's crazy as it sounds for somebody who's not religious. Like, why is that even a secret? Why does anybody even care? But people do care.
When you think of your story, where does it begin?
I would say it begins when I was a child. I think that the way I grew up, the way I was educated, everything brought me to this place.
Dvora was born into a religious community outside of New York City. Her family was...
somewhere between modern Orthodox and yeshivish. I wouldn't say it was super strict, as super strict religious families go, but strict enough for me. We had strictures on what we could wear and who we could talk to.
She was sent, of course, to a religious school for girls.
It was a don't ask questions kind of a school.
But from a very young age, Dvora was full of doubts.
I had questions. I wanted to know, well, why? Why are we doing this?
Even though her parents were relatively open-minded, she didn't feel she could share her existential thoughts with them.
I don't know. I felt like they just would not understand. I don't know why I felt that.
And it wasn't that she didn't try.
I do remember one time bringing up the God question to my parents, and it just didn't go well. They didn't know what to do with it, didn't really have the tools to give me the right answers or to give me answers, so eventually I ended up with no answers.
The lack of any guidance, of any outlet to explore her questions, led Dvora to a real crisis.
I lost my faith, and I was quite young. I mean, I was still in grade school. It was a very lonely and difficult time for me.
But since she wasn't much of a troublemaker, and didn't want to rock the boat, she just remained silent.
I always thought I was going to get in trouble. I always expected to get in trouble, and I had this very strong self-preservation thing that kicked in, and I protected myself probably much too carefully.
So, with all that, you might expect to hear that just as soon as she left her parents' house, Dvora also left the religious world. But, well, not quite. Instead, she started living a double life. Outwardly Orthodox, and inwardly, anything but.
And I made myself comfortable with that by saying, I'm protecting them.
Them being her parents in this case, but really, more generally, the world in which she had grown up. Everyone, seemingly, just preferred not to know.
I mean, that's true. But at the same time, I do think it is somewhat of a cowardly way to be, that I, you know, had to do things always secretly.
When she was 18, Dvora went off to college and started dating.
Religious, not religious. It wasn't important to me. It was just, oh, is he cute and do I like him, you know? And that was really the defining factor for me.
But it was important that they be Jewish?
I thought about it at one point. I thought to myself, what if, would I go out with a guy who wasn't Jewish? I probably would have. I probably did.
But true to herself and to her fear of disappointing her parents or causing a major stir in the community, Dvora ended up with Mr. Right.
I married the kind of person that I was expected to marry. So religious and what my parents wanted, they were thrilled.
She was 19.
We got married pretty quickly in a very orthodox, religious, kind of yeshivish sort of way. And, you know, we were going to be this nice religious couple, having nice religious kids in a nice religious community.
I asked her what she was thinking, standing underneath the chuppah. I mean, she already knew that this wasn't her, that this wasn't the life she wanted.
I kind of got swept into the whole dating and we're getting married and it's just happening so fast that I don't have time to breathe. And there were those thoughts of, what the hell am I doing? And there was a part of me that was saying, get off this ride now. But I didn't know how. It was like being caught in a tide. You're just in it and you just keep swimming because that's the only alternative, and that's the only alternative I felt at the time.
Dvora told me it all just happened too quickly, and she felt stuck.
But it was also a fun stuck, because it was, you know, a wedding, and it's exciting, and it's fun, and it's starting a new life, and I'm going to get to wear all these cool wigs, and how fun is that? Not fun, but it looked fun before I started wearing them. So I got caught into it. All my friends were in the same boat, so, and everyone was happy about being in that boat, so I could be happy too. And that was what we were for a number of years.
Dvora and her husband started having kids, 7 of them actually. And things were relatively simple. After all, the terms of their marriage and the commitment they had made to each other were very clear.
For him, it was very important to have a religious spouse and live a religious life. And, you know, we became more religious and more strict about things. And as part of that process, we decided that we would make Aliyah. And we did.
In the early 2000s, Dvora and her family packed up and left New York.
We were coming on Aliyah because we were religious, because it was something that we believed in as a mitzvah, something that, you know, as a Jew we're supposed to do, we're supposed to live in Israel, and therefore we are.
They moved into a small West Bank settlement in the Judean Hills, just south of Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
We didn't really understand Zionism. I couldn't have even like defined it for you at the time. And we didn't really have any understanding at all about the West Bank, Green Line, Eretz Israel, it's Israel, you know, we're going to move to a place that we like. ירבו אותך דרכיה של הארץ הטובה היא תקרא אותך אליה כמו אל ארץ אבה. One of the most appealing attributes of their new community was just how homogeneous it was. We wanted to be in a place where it was religious, where it was very clear that it was religious. I was, you know, in that religious mode at that stage of my life, so I was hoping that I was going to stick with it, I guess.
Dvorah thought that if only she surrounded herself with committed religious neighbors, they'd somehow rub off on her and help remove her blasphemous qualms.
I was actually in the mindset of like, okay, you know what, this is the right thing, this is right, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm committed to it, and I stuck with it for a while, but it just didn't last.
No matter how far she ventured or where she lived, those doubts that had been sizzling inside of her since she was a little girl, they never really went away.
I was going up and down religiously the whole time, and always to myself and not saying anything and not being open and honest because I was afraid because I would be, it would be disapproved, I would, you know, get in trouble, even though I was married and an adult.
What did it feel like not being able to share these doubts that you were having?
Lonely. It's very lonely.
As you can imagine, this all made for a very complicated daily existence.
I had decided that I no longer wanted to be religious while I was still being religious. I was saying, I don't want to keep Shabbos anymore, but I was keeping Shabbos.
With time, that started to change. It began with small stuff, turning on and off lights on Shabbat when no one was looking, sneaking a peek at her cell. The pro move, in case you were wondering, is taking the phone into the bathroom.
You know that no one's going to walk in on you. It's the safest place. I mean, where else could you go? You can't go into the closet. Someone's going to open the closet door, but the bathroom you can lock and you can be in there for a while and whatever. So.
But still, in a household full of observant people, in an Orthodox West Bank settlement, even that's a big risk.
Yeah, I take some chances. You know, and I notice that I'm taking more and more chances.
What's more, Dvorah felt conflicted about these transgressions. After all, she loves Shabbat.
I want Shabbat in my house. I think that it's wonderful. I think it's great for family. And I would never want to lose that.
So the end result of all this was a growing feeling of guilt and anxiety. Dvorah's lies were occupying more and more of her mental energy.
I mean, it was fear. You know, I would check my phone and it was like, I'd be like, you know, listening to every little footstep or whatever, like if the world would like, you know, come crashing to a halt if I was found out to be like, you know, sending a text.
And this whole time while all of this is going on, your husband is completely oblivious to it?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. He didn't know, didn't want to know. I did not feel safe and comfortable sharing those feelings, and I didn't. I knew he'd be upset, and I knew he'd be angry, and that he wouldn't take it well, but, you know, so what? I could have, like, manned up about it and just been honest. And I just kept it all to myself.
For years?
Years. Many years.
It wasn't just her husband and her kids that Dvorah was deceiving slash hiding from. It was everyone, literally everyone she knew.
Yeah, I would definitely think that anybody looking at us from the outside would see just a nice, happy religious family and would be really pretty surprised to find out what the reality is.
Dvorah realized that this couldn't go on much longer, that she couldn't go on like this much longer. There was no external event that broke her, no dramatic moment or argument that pushed her over the top. The mounting pressure, the hiding, the constant angst about what others would say if they found out, that's what made her come clean. After so many lonely years, she couldn't contain it anymore. and a couple of months ago she finally told her husband.
I'd had it with feeling nervous, like I was going to get caught, you know? I just wanted to not have that stress and that tension.
That conversation, the one she'd been dreading for decades, it didn't go well.
It was like that, you know, he was finding out that I was sleeping with someone. It was that severe. He was angry, blamed me, thought that it was my fault, that I should have done something about it, tried finding a way to prevent this from happening. And yeah, and I don't know if he's going to get over it.
Dvorah told me that since the talk, she and her husband barely communicate. They're more like roommates, she said, who live in the same house and have to discuss logistics. It's all still unfolding, and that's the reason she's so careful about not revealing herself.
Where do things stand now?
So I'm not sure how much I should say right now, because he doesn't even know where they stand. It doesn't stand in a very good place right now. I don't know that we'll be able to get over it, honestly.
And how does that make you feel?
Just is.
This story came with a lot of trust and a lot of responsibility. After years of silence, Dvorah decided to share her innermost thoughts with us, total strangers, before she did so with her own partner, with her own children. I've often wondered whether this was an act of liberation, of defiance, against her husband, her marriage, her community, or, really, against herself.
At some point, when it all comes out and people are aware of my reality, because I'm sure that's going to happen, what do I want to be? Where do I want to be? Like, who do I want to be? And that's a process, too, and it's something that I'm still thinking about.
So where do you hope to see yourself, say, in a year from now or 5 years from now?
Being honest with myself and the world around me. I don't know if I will be. I'd like to hope that I'll be able to find the courage to be who I am inside, even if that means that I'm changing all the time, because I'm okay with that.
If I were to go away, will you follow me till the end of the earth to show me what your love is worth? Or would you go and buy a car, shrug your shoulders, say that you are? She didn't love me anyway. If she had, she would have stayed. Say that is that. He didn't love me, now it's clear. If he had, he would be here.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1515.